Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I need to keep away from fruit. Black currants to describe Cabernet Sauvignon. Grapefruit for New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Plums for Merlot. Pineapple for Australian Chardonnay. People like me who write about wine spend a ridiculous amount of time thrashing around in a massive fruit salad of words. In the winter, we have some hope of keeping this malaise half under control. The sort of red wines that slip down well on a chilly December evening may be spicy, peppery, leathery, meaty, savoury, or just plain warming. But in summer, the greengrocer's lexicon threatens to run away with itself again. The bottles that seem most alluring waft out aromas of soft fruits. The Viognier in my fridge smells of peaches and apricots. The rosé you're planning to uncork when the sun shines is strawberry-scented. And that Pinot Noir to go with lamb chops. Wow! Raspberries, cherries, summer herbs. They're all in there with a tiny hint of well-hung game or the garden compost heap if you want to be absolutely accurate about it. The app for the Concise Oxford English Dictionary lists 153 edible fruits, every one of which has probably been pressed into service by a wine writer. How did it come to this? Suddenly enough, as it happens. In the 1970s, Anne Noble, a sensory researcher in the Department of Viticulture and Enology at the University of California, Davis, began to develop what she later termed an aroma wheel. Her idea was to provide a common vocabulary which wine tasters everywhere could use in their assessments, because up to that time, wine had no clearly defined language. One quadrant of the wheel features fruity aromas. There are 11 other segments, the most familiar covering wine smells that are floral, spicy, herbaceous, nutty, caramel, woody or earthy. A smallish red area labelled microbiological includes unnerving characteristics like mousy, horsey and sweaty. A quadrant labelled chemical lists a clatter of scientific terms: ethanol, ethyl acetate, mercaptan, sulfur dioxide, as well as immediately off-putting ones like skunk. While winemakers soon adopted all of this brave new wine vocabulary, wine writers focused mainly on Professor Noble's fruity, floral and spicy terminology. One of them was so influential that within a few years the fruit-laden approach had become the norm. In 1978, a wine-obsessed young American lawyer called Robert Parker launched The Wine Advocate, a magazine that would help him to achieve decades of recognition as the world's most powerful wine critic. Parker wanted to write about wines in a positive, vivid way. He launched into the new vocab with gusto, and readers lapped up his lavish tasting notes for 40 years. Here he is describing a Gigondas. Loads of blueberry, blackberry and blackcurrant fruit, intermixed with some licorice, camphor, graphite and spring flowers. A bit overblown, you might think, and I do too. But in the world of wine, anybody with a nose and palate insured for $1 million has tended to have popular opinion on their side. In the old days, I mean before about 1970, wines were described in broader and sometimes bolder terms. Deep colour and big shaggy nose, the English wine writer Gerald Asher wrote in the 1960s about a Nuit Saint-Georges. Rather a jumbly, untidy sort of wine, with fruitiness shooting off one way, firmness another, and body pushing around underneath. It will be as comfortable and as comforting as the 1961 Nuit Saint-Georges, once it is pulled in its ends and settled down. I love that. Not a word about cherries or raspberries, the labels pinned to young red Burgundies these days. A few years ago, while I was running a summer wine appreciation course, the usual fruit basket of descriptors became so wearisome that I paired my students off and asked them to compare two wines with reference to some sphere of life far removed from food or drink. The results were electrifying. One pair likened the wines to music by two very different composers, Mozart and Wagner, as far as I remember. Another, led by a Dublin estate agent, saw them as houses, one fancily done up but banal, the other neglected but oozing character. Then it was the turn of a suave gastroenterologist from the West. Before he could speak, his teammate declared she had no part in the description he was about to present and took extreme exception to it. On he ploughed, regardless. The first wine was a mistress, he said. Seductive. Irresistible, actually. But maybe a little bit flashy and eventually tiresome. The second wine, subdued but with more lasting appeal, was the faithful wife at home. The room erupted into outrage. The gastroenterologist was ostracised, and we relapsed into safe, fruit-driven language the next day.
All the signs were there. He had forewarning, beware the Ides of March, from the soothsayer tugging at his sleeve. He had the pathetic fallacy of fearsome thunder reflecting the political turbulence to come. His wife had a prophetic dream telling of his murder. By any measure, Julius Caesar should have stayed at home. The signs were there for us too, and, like Caesar, we ignore them. For it was the Ides of March, the 15th of the month in 1988. There was a storm brewing and snow forecast, and as we sat down on the train, my travelling companion realised he had left our match tickets at home. We should have bailed out then. We should have known, but we were young and confident, and Twickenham was calling. We would be loud in our response. The 80s was a turbulent time for Irish rugby. We had scored 6 tries for the entire Five Nations in 1986, 6 again in 1987, and now we had 4 to date in 1988. The 25-yard line had matriculated to the 22-metre line. Tries had gone from 3 points to 4, but had not yet reached 5, and the game was still a few years off professionalism. Like the addict who needs to hit rock bottom in order to change, things needed to get worse before they got better. And when the bottom did come, we were there, in the bleak landscape of a bitter South London, in a flock of sheepskin coats, bursting at the seams. It was the final match of the season, and both England and Ireland were staring at the wooden spoon. There was a joke at the time that it was harder to get off the Irish team than it was to get on it, so we were sticking tough to the core of the team that were losing so well all season. There had only been 2 changes in personnel over the entire winter, and one of them was due to injury. The old enemy had already lost to Wales in Twickenham, and were now throwing caution to the wind to blood some new talent. I felt, deep in my bones, we had a golden opportunity to catch England off guard. But once again, my flair for choosing optimism and hope over experience and reality was shining through. The match started well, and although a bit cold and turgid, our defence was holding up and we wore them down for the first 40 minutes. Despite their best efforts, we were 3 points to nil up at half-time, courtesy of a McKiernan drop goal. I had a creeping air of confidence. It might not be pretty, but in those days, it rarely was. Just before the stroke of half-time, the English scrum half Nigel Melville was tackled into touch and, colliding with an advertising hoarding, he broke his leg and dislocated his ankle. It was clear to all the distress he was in. Maybe it was this that shook the English team. Maybe Jeff Cook's half-time talk did it, or maybe the replacement scrum half just played a better game. Whatever it was, the team that took to the pitch for the second half was not the same. It was coming to the end of the Will Carling era, but names like Dean Richards, Wade Dooley, Rory Underwood, Simon Halliday and Brian Moore remind us of the strength of the side. We had our own heroes. We had Mick Bradley, Mick Kiernan, Donal Lenihan, Willie Anderson. Men big in stature and reputation. However, someone forgot to mention the name Chrysotti. A name I had not heard of before or since he ripped Ireland apart. He ran in 3 tries that afternoon in a performance that let the English run riot. Rory Underwood scored another 2 and Gary Rees added insult to injury with the 6th. Rob Andrew converted most. The score was 35-3. There were many records set that day, the 100th clash between Ireland and England, the Ides of March. It was the first time the Millennial Trophy was played for. But as Chrysotti scored his final try, a group of schoolboys near us began singing "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot." Other sections of the crowd joined in, and soon it seemed like the whole of Twickenham was singing it. It is a sad, haunting, spiritual hymn from America's deepest south, and although beautiful, its mournful air calls more for redemption than for winning a game of rugby. But on that day, it felt to us Irish fans like a giant chorus of Hebrew slaves lamenting the theatre of our unfolding defeat. It shook me to my bones. Was it the first singing of what was to go on to become the unofficial anthem of English rugby? Pundits argue, and I don't know for sure, but I do know that the anthem will resound again today. Perhaps what started with the Ides of March should end with Much Ado About Nothing. Why, what's the matter that you have such a February face, so full of frost, of storm and cloudiness?
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me.
The waiting room in the outpatients department of a public hospital I attended recently is large, functional and crowded. Think Bosaurus waiting room, and if you've never been there, imagine a bus station somewhere in East Germany before the wall fell. That takes care of the architecture. But this is not meant to be luxury, and you feel very lucky to have arrived at this point in the long and winding road called a hospital waiting list. To have arrived alive is practically a miracle. Sitting in this purgatory while waiting to enter the specialist waiting room, I am reminded of Jimmy O'Dea and his joke about Rathmines and Rathgar being a purgatory for souls awaiting the heaven of Fox Rock, where Samuel Beckett was from. Nobody tells you how long the wait will be, though you are given a number, so there you sit. There's a screen with daytime television, a new experience. You can't hear much, which is just as well, as you also have to keep an eye on another screen. It has boxes and numbers. It has the names of the different clinics, which flash up in sections. There's a little green man in a wheelchair or chair saying, "Good service." Later he changes to orange and says, "Minor delays." You wonder if he'll turn red and what he might say then. There are boxes and numbers on the screen which you think will let you estimate how many people are there before you. But the powers that be aren't that stupid. They have devised a system, a sort of code perhaps. The numbers have a sequence as complex as Fermat's theorem. You expect Dido and Gogo to show up any minute. Maybe they finally ascended in this quantum version of a Beckett play. The waiting times get longer rather than shorter. This you notice not by way of complaint, more out of interest. You're afraid you will miss your turn. After all, if the waiting time jumps from 25 minutes to an hour in the blink of an eye, might it not go backwards to zero just as fast? You seem to remember reading that time isn't as straightforward as it used to be, that it is, in fact, flowing in 2 directions. Your number might, in fact, be up at any moment. You get nowhere with that thought, so you start wondering why the waiting room reminds you of Dante and try to remember which circle or terrace you might be in and whether this is purgatory proper or just the anteroom, and you are silently going over the seven deadly sins, but you can only find six. Greed, gluttony, pride, envy, sloth, lust. However hard you try, there's one missing. Then you see Saint Joseph. He's not a well man. His colour is bad and he is thin with a long face. His tools seem too heavy for him and he is cocked up under the television looking as if he too is wondering what he's doing there. Is that a saint or is it Christ, your husband asks. Saint Joseph, you tell him with authority, look at his hammer. It's a mallet, he says. There's no saw, maybe health and safety took away his proper equipment. If this is the state Saint Joseph is in, you wonder what hope there is for you. You move your attention to the walls. There are posters saying, be smart, don't start, and have you had your NCT? This brings on a moment of cognitive dissonance. You decide the NCT poster is a joke. Feeble, unfunny, but well meant. There are two chocolate bar and crisp machines. There's a print of something, maybe a lotus. It's a very bad print, even for a hospital waiting room. As the room fills up, it gets hot and even more airless. There's a paper saying healthy food for life stuck to the wall with blue tack. Another poster in better shape and laminated says, tell us about your experience. This is from someone called the National Patient Experience Survey. There's a swishy little doodle on most of the posters in aqua or possibly green, like a rainbow that lost interest or gave up. There we all sit, like penitents at Mass, breathing in one another's germs and nerves being managed. When our time in this room or state is ended, we will be called upstairs, not to the heaven of the actual consultation, but to another circle or terrace. Many of us here are waiting for important news. I thought I should say that to you, patient survey. We're not waiting for Ryanair to whisk us off on our holidays. Here's my suggestion for improving the service. Clean up the air and lose the lotus.
Sitting here in limbo, but I know it won't be long. Sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song.
Quarantine is a word we're hearing on a daily basis at present, following the coronavirus outbreak in China and the ongoing efforts to curb the spread of the disease. Whether undergone voluntarily or by official sanction, a period of quarantine must be frightening to endure, while at least offering some reassurance for those not caught up in the spread of the disease. The word quarantine comes from the Italian quaranta giorni, meaning 40 days, a reference to a 40-day isolation period for ships, originating during the Black Death, which wiped out an estimated 30% of Europe's population in the 14th century. The notion of excluding or isolating the sick can be traced back, in written form at least, to the Old Testament. Through the centuries, outbreaks of illness have from time to time caused widespread concern. From cholera to yellow fever, typhoid to smallpox, to the 1918 flu pandemic, and more recently SARS and Ebola. Quarantine was also used to protect us from a more distant threat. NASA implied the practice after the first moon landings, when both the astronauts and the samples they brought back to Earth were isolated for a period of time due to fears of some kind of interplanetary contamination. As we here in Ireland now witness the implementation of plans to quarantine travellers from the Chinese province of Hubei and beyond, it's interesting to remember major Irish ports were once the scene of such facilities. As a child drift netting for salmon, I first saw an old concrete landing step on the riverbank just above Passage East in County Waterford. Whenever we approached it by boat, I was told about the hospital that it led to, and cautioned not to land there for fear of diseases such as cholera. The older generation remembered the timber and corrugated ivy-clad building that stood there, its windows broken, the ancient beds rusting against the walls, and open bandages strewn across the wooden floors. I was told how, in the past, ships arriving into the ports of Waterford or New Ross would stop at Passage East, where customs officials would check them over. Ships known to be arriving from ports where disease or illness was rampant were immediately put at anchor on a quarantine ground, a safe anchorage in the river away from other ships. The cargo was set out in the fresh air or fumigated before removal. Where ships had sickness aboard, they were required to fly a signal flag known as a yellow jack from the rigging when within 4 leagues of the coastline. At night, a lantern had to be shown. Individual sick sailors were rowed to the hospital at Passage, where they were cared for in isolation. Although I have read British parliamentary papers listing several major Irish ports requiring quarantine facilities and procedures as early as 1826, these appear to have not been introduced by the time of the worst outbreak in Waterford in the summer of 1832. Although on that occasion it was not an incoming ship that held the sickness, but an outbound emigrant ship from New Ross called the Lord Wellington. At that point, cholera was already in the country. It had first been reported on the island of Ireland in the port of Belfast in March. As it spread countrywide, so did terror. The illness wasn't fussy about who it infected, and young or old, rich or poor, all were struck down in its path. So those passengers in New Ross had probably embarked already infected. At Passage East, the fit and the sick fled the Lord Wellington, some collapsing on the quay and the roadside leading out of the village. In the absence of official direction, a courageous local minister and doctor were the first to lead the response, and an isolated cottage was designated as a temporary hospital. Over the next few days, the authorities started to take control of the situation. But at that stage, many of those aboard the Lord Wellington had fled back to their homes and villages. After assessment and consultation, the ship was ordered to sail to a quarantine ground at Milford Haven, where the remaining sick passengers were transferred to floating hospitals known as lazarettes, while the others were monitored aboard. The Lord Wellington subsequently sailed for its original destination, Quebec. It seems the quarantine hospital at Passage was established after this event, and it served this and other uses until the end of World War II. The scale of the present quarantine restrictions related to the coronavirus appear to be unprecedented in human history. As the virus spreads and the death count rises, there are fears that quarantine procedures may need to be re-evaluated and enhanced in the West. We can only hope that it doesn't come to that. But if it does, I expect that just like that day in Passage East, the compassion and courage of those on the ground will be vital in responding to the illness.
Returning home to Ireland, slowly, very slowly, after a lazy summer spent driving around France and Italy. Late one evening, towards the end of August, on the day before my 30th birthday, we reached the little town of Courmayeur. The town's small hotels all turned out to be full, and we couldn't sleep in the car. It was packed with goodies not easily found in Ireland in those days. Italian coffee, yellow peppers, fresh figs. So there was nothing else for it. We would see if the most expensive looking hotel in town had availability. To our delight, not only did the receptionist there offer us a room at a ridiculously affordable rate, but as a special extra, he threw in free tickets for the ski lift that would take us up the lower slopes of the nearby Mont Blanc the following day. This was promising to be one great birthday. The following morning, before heading off to tackle Mont Blanc, I first went downstairs to retrieve something from the car. There, in the very plush and very empty hotel lobby, all alone, stood Samuel Beckett. He looked just like he did in countless photos. I remember streaks of silvery hair standing up, a deeply tanned, deeply lined face, a bright blue checked shirt. He stood quite still, as if he were waiting for someone. There was no one else around. Time stood still. What should I do? Should I go up to the Nobel laureate and tell him that I was Irish? So what, he might think. Should I tell him how much I liked everything he had written? No, too gushing. Should I ask him for his autograph? Perish the thought. Everyone knows how much he valued his privacy, and anyhow, he was on holidays. Following some rapid agonising, I decided that the best thing to do was to do nothing. After a while, a woman of about his own age came down to join him. I followed them to the main door, which Beckett held open for me. At that stage, even if I had wanted to say something, anything, I simply couldn't. I was dumbstruck. The couple then drove off in a car with a Paris registration plate. And that was that. I returned to the reception desk. This was decades before current concerns around privacy and security. So I asked the receptionist how long more the Becketts were staying. Monsieur and Madame Beckett are staying another week, he replied, helpful as ever. So I left a note for Beckett. I explained that I had recognised him in the lobby, but that I hadn't wanted to disturb him. After all, he was on holidays. I told him how much I had always loved his work and that I had always found it bleakly funny, despite being told at university that it was simply bleak. I added that meeting him, or at least seeing him, was the best 30th birthday present imaginable, better even than a trip up Mont Blanc. And then I forgot all about it. But when we eventually returned home, among the usual bills and junk mail, nestled an envelope with an Italian stamp. It contained a postcard covered in small, neat, slanted, black, near illegible writing. The only words I could make out at first were the signature, "From Barbara." This I read with some annoyance, as most of the women in my family are called Barbara. My mother, grandmother, sister, a clutch of nieces and a constellation of cousins. Wouldn't you think she'd say which Barbara she is, I grumbled. And then the fog lifted. The two-word sign-off did not read "from Barbara," but "Sam Beckett." "Thanks for your moving letter. Sorry you didn't talk to me," he wrote, before adding, "best wishes for the third decade and thenceforward, Sam Beckett." It is well known that Beckett was a prolific correspondent. The four-volume edition of his letters, published by the Cambridge University Press, weighs in at over 5.5 kilos and contains almost 3,500 pages. My single, unexpected, handwritten postcard contains just a couple of dozen words and weighs in at a mere 6 grams. Nonetheless, for me, it remains something precious, unique and heartwarming. And for the arithmetically sharp amongst you, you may have spotted a mistake in Beckett's message. Contrary to what he wrote, my 30th birthday was the start not of my third but of my fourth decade. So, could this be an entry point into a study of mistakes and misunderstandings in the work of Samuel Beckett?
On this morning's programme, we heard "Too Fruity for Words" by Mary Dewey, "Try, Try Again" by Donal Hayes, The Waiting Room by Mary O'Malley, Quarantine by Andrew Doherty, and Waiting for Beckett by Grace Neville. The music was Libiamo from La Traviata by Verdi, sung by Luciano Pavarotti, Joan Sutherland and the London Opera Chorus, conducted by Richard Bonning. Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, sung by Mavis Staples. Sitting Here in Limbo by Jimmy Cliff. And Open the Door Softly by Donal Clancy on vocals and guitar, with David Power on whistle and Kieran Summers on flute. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.